Jackie Wilson.
Blog Talk Radio.
Peace to the ancestors. Yes. Peace to Dr. Cornell West. Yes. Peace to the movement. Came from the bottom, ever since they got us, we've been going through these problems. 400 years behind and it's no promise that we gon' never actually be equal, to be honest. It's messed up how they put us in chains, kidnapped our language and changed our names. But when we speak Ebonics, then they call it a shame. They leave us with a couple options, rob or slain. Now we locked up again. How much can our skin take? We went from slaves to inmates, carrying the weight of the 50 states, working your forms. Black nannies carrying white babies in their arms. Black men sacrifice their lives in your wars. But you'll never show appreciation here at home. You treat us so damn wrong. You act like you hate my race. The police, they just beat us in the streets like an 808 base. America, when will you defend my case? It never will, cause your freedom is fake. I'm only living here cause I wanna get paid enough to round up all my family and shake.
Get up, get up. Get up, get up. Get up, get up.
Worst case scenario, might work till a couple of quirks. Can't call it pancakes cause you pour some syrup. It's a whole lot bigger than a pretty new house, especially when the road's still running about. P. Diddy running marathons, racing dough. That's going to the school where the tax money go. Homeland Security, now there's a phenomenon. Pacifying folks by hanging Saddam. Truth still riding, still obliging, still no Bin Laden. Tuned in waiting for the president's announcements. No 40 acres. Take these 40 ounces. We ain't gon' get on the levees. Revolution televised early. Is you ready?
Why you wanna treat me so cold, America?
Forced to climb and shit and have your back, have you beat and lost your mind. Especially when you done been down for so much time. Getting up don't even really ever cross your mind. You got pawn shop, gun shop, liquor store time. SWAT team, crack fiends, unemployed line. Stay late, dollar short, trying to buy time. What we do to survive is defined as a life of crime. You get bored then you forced to grind. If you fall then you cross the line. And I've been putting in work from 9 to 5 and 5 to 9. Since phone calls cost a dime. What it made me is one of the relevant, highly intelligent. Brothers not only dealing with the same drugs selling. If I'm a hustler, then what's more American? We all founded on the same drug heritage.
America, why you wanna treat me so cold? America, I done gave you all that I own. America, took me from my mama so young. America, locked me up and gave me your name.
America, 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 you know the black freedom movement. You know we've been trying to redeem the soul of the nation. Even as that nation been trying to render us soulless. So we're our soulful people, the blues people. We've been keeping alive the blood stained banner of democracy. Thank God for those who came before. We shall never forget them and always move forward with grace and dignity.
America, why you wanna treat me so cold? America, I done gave you all that I own. America, took me from my mama so young.
America, America, it's time to wake up. That song was by Dr. Cornell West, produced on Hidden Beach Records back in 2007. The music was produced by my own son, Corey Coachy Tatum. The first rapper was I Riz the Moment. That was my youngest son, followed by Rod Digga, Black Thought, and, of course, Dr. Cornell West. We have an exciting program. My name is Dr. Tatum from the West Coast, California. We're on the Dr. Mary Lee Live Show. We're going to be talking about the entertainment business, Motown. We got a special guest tonight. We got Mr. Bobby Wilson, the son of the soul singer Jackie Wilson. And you remember Jackie Wilson? Songs like Higher and Higher, Lonely Teardrop, A Baby, Work It Out. Bobby, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
What is
okay,
now, Bobby Wilson, say hi to everybody. Then we're gonna get you over to Dr. Lee. Say a little bit to the audience, Bobby Wilson.
How you doing, everybody? Welcome, welcome, welcome. God bless you all. I'm honored to be here and to be a part of this forum.
Amen. Tell them what you're doing, Bobby, and how you've been emulating your dad, and how you've been traveling, how God has been blessing you.
Well, God's been blessing me from the start. You know, I was raised in a foster home. I didn't find out about Jackie Wilson until I was in my 30s, and by that time I started working with a doo-wop group called the Love Notes out of Hawaii, which happens to be Bruno Mars's family, because I met him at 6 years old, and we've been working together off and on until he became a superstar. I went on my own path and started promoting Jackie Wilson's music as my own. I've been doing it for years with the help of my brother, who's now passed, Thor Wilson. He passed a couple of years ago. Wow, 3 years ago now. And but I'm just keeping on, holding on. God has blessed me in so many ways. I was a sickly child and a speech impediment. And like I said, I was raised in a foster home, and now I run my own business and entertainment company. I hire acts, I book acts as myself, and write songs. I got a couple of songs coming out very, very soon, and some acting. You know, I got some movie stuff happening. So, God is good. That's all I can say.
Amen, Brother Bobby. I'm gonna turn it over to Dr. Lee and Michael Tynes. Of course, you know, Mr. Jackie Wilson, his dad, was born June 9th, 1934, in Detroit, Michigan. So you know Motor City. We owe a lot of love to Mr. Jackie Wilson, and this is his son, Bobby. So Dr. Lee or Michael Tynes is in your hands.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Tatum. Go ahead, Michael. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I just wanted to make sure we have Dr. Lee here after, just in case Dr. Cannon comes on. So my name is Michael. As Mr. Tatum said, I primarily act as a community advocate for self-sufficiency and socioeconomic opportunity in the Black community. And I've been a fellow co-host of the show for some time now, helping to facilitate conversations with illustrious guests, such as the guests we have on tonight, and you know, help the guests that come on share their experience with those who tune into our show so that they can get a better peek or a better look into the lives of some of the individuals that come through here and talk with us and share their experience. So before we get into the show, I do want to see if Dr. Cannon is on the line so he can say his opening introduction, say his two cents. If not, then we can go directly to Dr. Lee.
Thank you so much, Michael, and thank you, Dr. Tatum. At this time, I don't believe that that Dr. Cannon has joined us yet, but when he does, we will offer him up the platform. I want to thank you all for joining us. I'm very excited about tonight's show. I want to thank our special guest, Kern Brantley, who is phenomenal, has a phenomenal background in the music industry of producing, and we'll let him share with us tonight. But we're just so grateful to have you here, and I want to thank Bobby Wilson for being here with us. Of course, we loved and grew up on your dad's music, and I want to say thank you for joining us. And tonight, definitely, we're talking about music. We're talking about Motown tonight, and Detroit Motown. There's so many of us who grew up with the sound, and it has influenced and impacted the world of music in every way longer than any other sound before and afterwards. And we all know the history of Motown, Berry Gordy, and the great success, and the moving out to California, So many were left behind, and you all know me, know that I'm about those who were left behind, particularly in the area of entrepreneurship, business, making money, any kind of way we can make money. That's what Dr. Mary Lee is about. And so we're excited about being here. We're concerned about the music, the descendants of those who went on. And Detroit is still very rich in music, extremely rich and powerful. And we want to talk about that tonight. And we're talking about bringing Motown back. We are on the road. We're on the way. And we're going to do it. We're going to do it. It's not like bringing it back because it never went anywhere. Music is still there in the hearts of all. And so we're so very excited. I'm going to turn it over to you now, Michael, and for you to lead out on this conversation tonight. I want everyone to feel comfortable. We're just pretending to be at home in our living rooms having a conversation, talking about bringing Motown back. And we'll just, I want
Before you do that, let me just ask you, do you have any, are there any preference as to who you want to start with first, Mr. Wilson or Mr. Brantley, so they can give their introductions?
Well, we'll start with Mr. Wilson. His time is limited, but we do want Kern to say hello and say give us a little introduction, and we'll go right on back over. So, okay, go ahead. Go ahead, Michael.
Oh, okay. Mr. Wilson, are you on the line?
Yes, sir.
Okay, for those who are listening who maybe didn't hear, I know you said a little bit about yourself earlier when Dr. Tatum asked you. Could you just again, you know, give us a brief intro as to who you are, your career, what you do, what you've done?
Okay, thank you. My name is, I'm Bobby Wilson. I born and raised in a foster care home. My mother gave me up at birth. She was very young, and I don't think, Jackie knew nothing of me. It wasn't, and when I was born, I had a lot of ailments. I think I was a preemie baby. I'm not really sure, but I was born in a house in Westbury, Long Island, New York. And my mother released me to the state of South Carolina. And that's where I grew up, and they fixed my legs. I had rickets at the bones. Underdeveloped lungs and underdeveloped intestines. They took care of that. Plus, I have a speech impediment and took care of all that. So you would never known I had all of that. At the time, the doctors were saying I was 98% disability, and they didn't think I would make it to double digits as a child. But God took over. I was in a strong Christian home and stayed there until I aged out, got married, joined the Navy. And upon getting out of the Navy is when I started music. Bruno Mars' father, Pete Hernandez, saw me singing in a karaoke bar. And this is kind of funny because I had never heard of karaoke before, and I picked out My Girl by The Temptations and sung that song. And when I did that song, Pete said he was blown away by my voice, asked me to join the group, and that's when I started getting my chops. The more I became an entertainer, the more people start shouting from the audience, "You look like Jackie Wilson. I wonder if you sound like him." And at the time when I started out, I was a backup singer, but by the time I developed and started growing in the business, I wanted to do my own music. And I was introduced to the Wilson family mainly to the Four Tops. They saw me singing in Atlantic City, New Jersey, at Valley's. And they summoned me by way of the entertainment director. And next thing I know, I'm standing before them asking a bunch of questions. And they introduced me. They knew who my mother was. They introduced me to the rest of the Wilson family. And that became history. I became sort of a mantra, for lack of a better word, carrying Jackie's legacy with me everywhere I go. I guess because of my resemblance and the way I am, I look and sound so much like him that people are hypnotized, including Berry Gordy, whom I met about 10 years ago when I was attending Harvey Fuqua's memorial service. Berry Gordy walked up to me and said, "You just took me back 50 years." And I said, "It's an honor to meet you, sir." And he said, "Oh, my God, you talk like him." he looked like he saw a ghost. He grabbed my hand, and he wouldn't let me go for 30 minutes. People were trying to get in, and he was, like, asking me a million questions. And next thing I know, I was introduced to the rest of the Motown family. I introduced it to Smokey, and of course I knew the Tops and the Temps, and Martha Reeves, who's celebrating her birthday pretty soon, adopted me as her godson, and I continued my work, and I've been doing it for over 20 years. I got signed by a record label out of Nashville, and I had 4 hit songs off an album called It's About Time. Which the song "It's About Time" I wrote myself, and then now I'm on a new label called DJ International Records out of Chicago, and they're about to release 2 more songs on me in the summer. So I'm blessed in more ways than one. I'm blessed, and that's my life. That's where I'm at. So Motown is a big part of my life. Motown music.
Yeah.
I grew up listening to it in my sickly years when I was young and I couldn't go out and play. I was listening to the Top Temptations and Supremes. I would listen to Tina Turner and Otis Redding and Johnny Taylor, Jackie Wilson, of course, which I didn't know. And I remember rocking to the music because I didn't have the energy to sing or dance. And I couldn't walk until they fixed my legs. So my first 4 or 5 years, I was on the couch while the other kids were playing. And then after I got my braces, after I wore my cast for 2 years and then they took the cast off, I was able to wear a brace around me like Forrest Gump. And overcome all that, joined the Navy, played basketball, ran cross country for high school, did a lot of stuff. A lot of different jobs, and today I'm an artist, and I work part time booking other acts, promoting other acts, and promoting shows. That's what I do now. So, and I carry the word of Christ with me everywhere I go.
Excellent, thank you. You mentioned that Berry Gordy was the pipeline for you to get involved with Motown. Obviously, you said that you were already aware of Motown and you listened to a lot of Motown when you were younger, but could you go into a little bit more detail as to what that process was like, getting involved in Motown through Berry Gordy?
Well, what he did was he basically let everybody know I was around. That's what he did. He asked for my management at the time, which I gave him, and then he said, at the time when I met him, I hadn't released my CD. So he said, as soon as that comes out, send it to him. We did. And he did a great article on me and is on his website. And he wanted, I guess he acknowledged me. And what do you call it? He kind of put the stamp on me. He said he measured all his entertainers by Jackie Wilson. He measured every singer by Jackie Wilson. And as far as he's concerned, there has never been a greater entertainer, a greater singer. And for me to come out of nowhere and to jolt him the way I did, I think he was just overcome with memories, and I just saw his reaction. It was just, it was like, I don't know how to describe it. But he introduced me to a lot of different people in the business, like I said, Smokey Robinson and different producers, Mickey Stevens. I wound up doing a show with Mickey Stevens, 50 Years of Motown, after I met Berry Gordy. which I'm sure Barry had me thrown in there, and then Al Abrams, which was his original promotions director, wrote my liner notes for my first album. And they basically saw me as a Motown act because they saw Jackie Wilson as a Motown act. He just never got signed with him. He was with Brunswick, of course, to the end, but I think that's how Barry saw him. So I was on it.
Excellent, excellent. And in your opinion, what would you say were the most memorable or impactful connections you made while in Motown?
Harvey Fuqua and all the great stories. All the great stories about what was happening and how they accomplished this and how they accomplished that, and the secrets that most people don't know that I am privy to because of a lot of the guys. You know, they went through a lot to make that label happen. Anna Gordy and Barry Gordy's sisters, you know, at the business before Barry Gordy was. You know, Anna, the oldest sister, she already had a Believe Camera, and she had a couple acts on it. I believe the Ames, which were the Four Tops, were signed with her. So it was a lot. I learned a lot about publishing. I learned a lot about marketing through Motown contacts. Mickey Stevens, if you ever heard of him, he was A&R for Motown, and he taught me. He opened up a whole new world to me, to be honest. The impact on Motown is big for me, and also. You know, little Bruno Mars, which he was just little Bruno, when I used to pick him up from high school in Hawaii, when he moved to L.A. to live with his sister, Kalani, she wound up managing him, and next thing you know, he got signed to Motown. I don't know if everybody knows that. And they kept him only 9 months, and they dropped him because they said they didn't know what to do with him. Which is strange, because I know they're probably thinking now, boy, we let that big fish slide. Motown is still going. I mean, they have their own acts. It seems to be more hip-hop than anything else, or rap now, today's Motown. The music has changed so much and dramatically. My goal is to bring it back, to take a little bit of what they're doing now and go back to the original style of music of the original Motown. And the original Motown was not easy music. The original Motown music was very complicated music. All of the musicians were jazz musicians, very strong musicians. So to play one of the Supreme songs, you couldn't play it with three chords. No disrespect to the great Little Richard, but all Little Richard songs were three chord changing songs. You can play them in your sleep, but you couldn't play a Bernadette in your sleep and the changes with Bernadette. You couldn't play Papa with a Rolling Stone in your sleep. No. Now, those songs were orchestrated in such a way. Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5, Never Can Say Goodbye. Those songs were full orchestrations with violins and changes that seasoned jazz artists could play, but not an average musician. And I think that's what caught the ear of the world. I really believe that.
You know, I'm going to jump in here. Thank you. Thank you so much, Bobby. My question, which you basically have answered it, was, you know, your take on bringing Motown back, you know, as with some of these original sounds right there in the city of Detroit, you know, where it started. And, you know, with there being so many, you know, descendants, you know, offspring I call left behind. And so the music is still embedded right there in Detroit. I'm Michigan is my native state. But I also grew up in Detroit, and of course, during that the era of the music, the sound, and we are right now as we're speaking, you know, embarking upon this endeavor to bring it back, and that's the purpose of this our show tonight. You know, to talk about it. We're planning. We're working on it, and just would welcome you to be a part of it. A little bit more feedback if you've got time.
I actually had one more question for Mr. Wilson before we get to that, Dr. Lee. Mr. Wilson, I'm just curious. You said that you learned a lot in Motown that's helped you later in life, certain principles that you've been able to apply. Is there anything that you learned in Motown that you'd be willing to share with us that you use now that has helped you greatly, say in business or some other avenue?
The determination and the work ethics that they had, I pass that on to the kids that I motivate. It's three young artists I'm working with right now, and when they ask for advice, I give pretty much the same advice that I got from some of the heavyweights like Smokey and Mickey Stevens and others. As far as constructing the song, as far as promoting the song, marketing the song, because those guys did all the work. They did it from the ground up. Nobody helped them. And if anything, everybody tried to hinder them. So when I hear a young artist complain about I can't get my music out, and I said, dude, you got more venues to get your music out now than anyone's ever had in the whole time of music business. So the whole thing is, I think that I got from them is obedience, a goal, a plan, and to work your plan. And without those things in place, you can't go nowhere. It's like a car with no gas. But with everything in place and working a goal, and you wake up with that and you go to sleep with that, and you leave it into the hands of God to direct and guide you, you're going to be all right. You're going to get where you want to go. It might not be today. It might not be tomorrow, but it's going to happen. I always tell the kids, aim for the stars, and you might land on the moon. But keep your goals up there. Don't make your goals impossible. Then you'll know there's a God somewhere, because I've done that many times where I asked for the impossible and it happened.
Mm-hmm.
It came true. And the only reason why is because of my belief that I gave it to God, and I continued to work my plan. And everything I've learned, I got from those guys. Smokey is probably 80 years old. He's still writing songs. No such thing as retirement. I got a chance to do a cruise with him 2 years ago called the Malt Shop Cruise, and I got to spend some quality time with him. And this man's brain is probably about as active as it was when he was 25 years old with Motown. He's got all kind of ideas and all kind of things he want to do, and he's not thinking, I'm 80 years old, I'm ready to go to heaven. He's thinking, I got work to do as long as I can breathe. So I admire that. I mean, I had somebody in my past ask me, when do you plan on retiring? I said, I don't know. I mean, as long as God's got me breathing, I'm going to keep moving and keep making things happen. I think that's our job anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're here just to sleep, eat, make babies, and die. I don't believe that. I believe we are creators. We are God's child, or we're God's children, and our God is a creator. Therefore, we are sons and daughters of a creator, which makes us creators. And I believe we can't survive unless we are creating something.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're not creating anything, then we pass. That's where I get it.
Well, and there's an old saying that. Absolutely. There's an old saying that if you love what you do, you never really work a day in your life. So I think you've pretty much exemplified that.
Yes, sir.
Now, I did have, I know I said I only had one more question, but I have one more question. Were there any misconceptions you had about the industry from the outside looking in that once you became a part of it and worked within it, you corrected or you were educated on?
That was no misconception. My mother, who raised me, used to preach to us when we were 7 and 8 years old that nobody's going to protect you or care for you but God. She used to tell us, because we were all foster children in the home, I don't want to hear you don't have a mama, you don't have a daddy, you don't have an uncle, you don't have a... She says, you got God, and that's all you got, and that's all you need. Now, it's true that we need each other, which that I learned. We all need each other in this world. But at the same time, when it gets down to significant changes in our life where nobody can help us, no matter who we know, no matter how much money we got, nobody can heal our body but God. Nobody can open that door that we're closed and slammed in our face many, many times but God. That's where her teachings for me kicked in. And I think it got me prepared for the music industry. I had a seasoned artist say to me when I was 40 years old, which was 2 years ago. Anyway, he said, how in the hell are you working? And I've got 5 platinum songs, but you're working more than me. And I didn't answer him. But I knew the answer. My answer was, I never stopped working because I had a hit song. I never left my direction in somebody else's hand. I never waited for the phone to call ring. I rang the phone. I rang everybody's phone off the hook. Billy Roquel Davis, which was publisher for many artists, used to tell me, he said, Bobby, one thing, we don't have to worry about you. You're going to catch the door before the door slams. So somebody might slam a door in my face, but it won't slam because I'm going to catch it and I'm going to walk through if I can. And I thank Mom, her name was Annabelle Davis from Cordia, Georgia. I believe she's the one that put that in me. She gave me the strength to deal with this community because when I got out of the Navy, I was special weapons tech. Basically work with nuclear weapons. I had military jobs waiting on me, government jobs waiting on me when I got out. But I left that all for music because a door opened for music, which I didn't really know that I wanted to walk through. I knew I liked singing on my own time, but I didn't never look at it as a career until that fateful day that I asked God to give me a career as a singer. That's a different story altogether. We'll be here all day.
Excellent, excellent. I don't know if anyone else on the panel, any of the other co-hosts, wanted to chime in.
I have a question. This is Dr. Lee, and I also see Dr. Cannon has joined us. But I have a question. What do you think would have happened to Motown sound or any portions of it had Berry Gordy not sold Motown?
I'll just say because when Berry sold Motown, you know, nobody was looking ahead. It's like the Beatles. They weren't looking 30 years down the road at the new generation going to fall in love with them. And I think that's what happened with Motown. Berry Gordy had built his kingdom, and it was traditional for owners to sell their businesses after a certain time, and that's what he did. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't hold it against him. I think that's how business was. But I gotta say this before I get cut off. Bruno Mars, even though he's doing his own thing, he's kind of bringing back Motown because when he did that song, Leave the Door Open, I don't know if you have heard it, but if you haven't heard it, please go listen to it. It sounds like Motown orchestration from the first chorus. As soon as I heard the first chorus, I heard Never Can Say Goodbye by Michael Jackson. And because I remember the chord structure of that song. Bruno has 35 chord changes in that song. And so I think that even though I think, and I can't speak for him because I don't, but he loved Motown so much, he wanted to be Motown.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of his music reflects the basics of Motown. I really do. That's just mm-hmm. my opinion. You know, he never said anything mm-hmm. to me. But when I listen mm-hmm. to what he's putting out, because, you know, when it comes to R&B, he's very close to the Barry Gordy formula. He's very close to, you know, what Stevie Wonder mm-hmm. and all those cats were writing. So that's just my opinion.
Thank you. But before you go, I do want to ask Kern Brantley, our special guest tonight, I want to ask you if you would have a question. I want to give you the opportunity to ask a question of Bobby Wilson if you'd like to. Kern.
Oh, okay. Yeah, how you doing, Mr. Wilson?
I'm good. How are you, sir?
Yeah. Good, good. I just want to tell you, like, we really appreciate, you know, I know we recently had a street named here in Detroit after Jackie Wilson, and that's when I got a chance to meet Miss Brenda and talk to some of them. I just want to let you know that we really appreciate, you know, the family and your legacy and what you guys have done for the next generation of musicians. Do you think that, like, your dad's influence is like, I know I can see Bruno Mars, I can see the Jackie Wilson in Bruno Mars. So,
right.
You know, how do you think about your dad influencing this current generation of artists?
A lot of them don't know him. I don't think a lot of people know Jackie Wilson in this current
The ones in Detroit know him. The Detroiters know him.
Well, yeah.
Like, if you ask any singer in Detroit, they'll know. Yeah.
Yeah, I believe that. I believe Detroit do know him. But when I'm in Las Vegas and I see, you know, I have a natural kids attraction. When I was 16 years old, I was a superintendent of our Sunday school, and my minister noticed that the kids were always attracted to me. And so next thing I know, I'm running the Sunday school. So that has never left me. So when I get around, when I do a show, say, on a cruise ship, I'm surrounded by 20 or 30 young kids from the ages of 9 to 16, and they're asking me questions, and the first thing they say to me is, "Are you Black Elvis?" And I go, "Funny you say that." Nope. Because Elvis used to call my dad Black Elvis. And they said, "Elvis used to call your father Black Elvis?" I said, "Yes. Elvis and my dad were best friends. And he called them Black Elvis. And my dad called Elvis the White Jackie Wilson. And they were very tight. And I said, and his music was very strong during that time when Elvis was out. I said, you guys should go and listen to it. And they have their phones. They are Googling Jackie Wilson while I'm talking to them. And they go, "Oh, my God, you look just like him." And, you know, and they react. I said, "Well, listen to the music and come back to me." Because usually it's the first day. Kids just walk up to me and go, "Are you an artist?" The first day on a 7-day cruise. And I laughed because, you know, I said, "That's all God." And I said, "Yeah, I'm an artist." And then I said, "Google Jackie Wilson." They Google Jackie Wilson. I said, "Listen to the music. Come back and tell me what you think." And they do. They go, "Oh, my God, his voice is amazing. You sing like that?" I said, "No, I have my own sound." I said, "But that was the first influence."
Wow.
I take what God gives me and use it. When I walk on stage, people who remember my dad go, you hear that as soon as I walk on stage. And then I do my show, and then people fall in love with me. So it's cool. It's really cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much. Dr. Cannon, I see you're here. Want to chime in?
Yes, ma'am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Beautiful, beautiful, everybody. Outstanding show, Brother Wilson. We appreciate you so much. Appreciate your family, the love, the motivation that you have to pick up the baton and take it to the next level.
Yes, sir.
You know, when we think about the fact, everybody, that we're living in a generation now that the foundation that has been set before us, well, we know for sure that America has loved our music. We know we've stimulated industries from jazz to blues to R&B to hip-hop to, you know, we've stimulated and we've proven we can do it better than most. And we've proven that the whole world can love our style. In my thoughts, ladies and gentlemen, when Dr. Lee, Michael, and the team, when we look at bringing back something that we've proven that people will take home and love, they will love our music, and they would dance to it and stay up all night with it. If we think about bringing that back, really, it's not so much bringing it back as if it is taking it to the next level. When we look at the fact that the whole world now is waiting, and we've proven that here in America we can hit the charts and we can hit the numbers, and now we have platforms, everybody, where from your church, from your family, you can create your Motown, and you can bring three or four churches together. You can bring three or four organizations together, and we can push our product to the world. If we saturated Detroit and we saturated Chicago, when we saturated the United States, the whole world would love our music. So where our ancestors didn't make the type of money, they weren't able to live the type of lives for real. But my next book that's coming out is going to be, it's a numbers game. And when we look at, ladies and gentlemen, we've proven through hitting baseball and football, and we've proven in writing and doing comedy that the whole world will love our style. It's not about bringing it back. It's about taking it to the next level now. Get the Chinese in China loving it. The income will come to you. Get the Europeans in Europe to love it. Now we can bypass the record label. Now we can bypass the publishing companies. But we gotta have a little bit more chutzpah, a little bit more motivation. It's easy to see the whole system changing, and we want to sit back and wait and see what happens. I think we need to jump in front of the change and take those things that we've proven, not just for Detroit, but now, your goal is for the whole world to love this music. And if we have to push the music that our grandparents and our fathers love just to get the ball rolling again, then they've left us great catalogs that we can make sure that the world reads our books now, make sure that the world hears our music. If they didn't know Brother Jackie Wilson, then the whole world should know him now. And upon that foundation, if we make it the goal, Detroit knows him, Chicago knows him, well, bring that music back. Let the kids sing it. Set up contests across the nation. Do some things over the Internet where they begin to sing it, not just in the United States, but the whole world is at our feet, y'all. Where Booker T. Washington said, pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. At that time, we didn't have bootstraps. But now we've got some of y'all. Got to shoot them and take them to the front of the line. I commend you, my brother. I commend your movement. I commend your music. I bless you. I bless your music. But I say take it to the next level. Because that's the opportunity that's on the table. It's not us against us. It's us against all that that's out there, and it's a whole lot out there. And if we bite and devour and fight each other and destroy each other, then we're going to miss our creativity that we have. We've got creativity like none other. And if we go back and put it together, push it to the world, then we'll find that the gold will come back to us. And I think we should be the richest people in America. if not the second richest. When the children of Israel left out of Egypt, Moses told them to go back and borrow all the silver and all the gold from the Egyptians. That was a miracle. That was a supernatural hint to God that they gave it to them. They gave all the silver and all the gold to the Hebrews when they left out of Egypt. God supernaturally multiplied what they were doing. And that's what he wants to do for us right now. He wants to put his super on top of our natural. But we do all that we know we need to do and all we can do. Put your natural out there. God's going to put his super on top of it and show you how to supernaturally, my brother, get done everything that's in your heart to get done. I appreciate you tonight, Dr. Lee.
Thank you, and thank you. I appreciate you so very much. Go ahead, Mr. Wilson.
Well, I want to tell Doctor that when I was a child, I used to pray, make me an instrument of our faith. And I didn't understand what it meant. I just thought I was going to be a servant of God. And when this Jackie Wilson thing started appearing in my life, I didn't understand it. I'll be honest. I didn't. I kept asking God, why Jackie Wilson? Why Jackie Wilson? And I remember hearing, be patient and all things will be revealed unto you. And things were being became more and more apparent. So at this particular point in my life, I felt I was chosen to keep his music alive, as well as him paving my own career as a musician, as a singer and a writer and a producer. So I now stop questioning God about anything, and I just follow his lead. I pray the prayer of Jabez, where he keeps his hand on me and he guides me and protects me, and he takes away the pain that I experience in this life, and so that I can have heaven on earth instead of waiting till I get to heaven. And so far, that's what God has done. So I appreciate all your words, and I do believe there's going to be a new Motown, because we have to advance Motown from where it was to where it could be. And I see the world opening up. I see the covers that were covered are no longer covered. Light is shining in places that where no light was before, and the truth is being revealed, whether people like it or not. In America, especially,
that's all right.
The truth is
that's
being revealed. And we're going to have to deal with the truth. All of us are going to have to deal with the truth as it comes out. America, I love this country, but it's not as clean as it likes to paint itself. And as God says in the Bible, all things will come to light that's done in the dark. And the history was changed. The names were changed. The faces
that's
were changed.
Right.
The skin color was changed. And all of that is being revealed. So the world is going through a change, and nobody's doing it but God. I don't think this is
that's
the end times. A lot of people are preaching this is the end times and God's coming back. I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's way too much
okay.
worry. And like I said that what I said before, I'll say it again. We are children of God. We are creators, co-creators. Our Father is a creator. Our Father is rich. Therefore, we're rich, and our Father was able to move. Therefore, we're able to move mountains. We just don't know it, and the devil don't want us to know it. But we can move mountains. We can heal the sick. We can raise the dead. He told us that. It's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You follow me, and you'll do as I do. And so being the child of God, being the son of God, that my God has given me, all I can do is keep that door open and have God walk me through it. I can't do it on my own. And then he sent me many leaders such as yourself and many mentors such as yourself to help us get to the path that he wants us on. I believe
right.
that we got a long way to go, and this world will be unified before God comes back. I believe that we'll
that's
all
right.
be on one accord before God comes back. So
yes, God,
I believe
you're absolutely
these
right.
are hard. I believe these are hard times and trying times, but I also believe this is not the end times. People have been trying to predict the end times ever since I was a baby. Ever since I used to listen to Billy Graham preaching in the '70s, people were always predicting these are the end times. The end times are when God said they're the end times. Right now, we should concentrate on living and doing what you want us to do. That's why I'm
totally agree. Totally agree. Appreciate you so very much, sir. And we know we went over your time that you had allotted, but certainly appreciate you very much. And we're going to definitely want you to come back, okay?
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you so much.
Yes.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for allowing me to share.
And God bless you all, and you're all covered by the blood of Christ.
Amen. Thank you so very much. Thank you. Okay, so we want to go to Kern, our special guest tonight. Thank you for joining us again. And before we turn it over to Michael, how about you just giving us some of your background and what you've done? And you've got an extensive background, so if you'll go ahead and start to share, would appreciate it.
Yes, definitely. Thank you so much for inviting me. Thank everybody on the forum here. So I'm from Detroit. I've always lived here. I've never moved to L.A. I've never lived in Atlanta or New York or Europe. I've always been a Detroit guy, but God has blessed me to travel around the world. I think maybe 65 countries, all from Detroit as a music director. So I'll just go through some of this, some of my musical director. So most recently for 2018, all the way up into the pandemic, I was working in China with an Asian pop star by the name of J.J. Lin, who's like the Michael Jackson of Asia. He's from Singapore. So we had been touring all around Asia, playing stadiums. That band was put together by Mr. David Foster, the producer. So I played with David a few shows, and then he wound up putting together the band for Jay Lin in China. Previous to that, I was the bassist for Lady Gaga for maybe like 6 years. Then before that, I worked with Beyonce, a musical director for Beyonce, music director for Destiny Child, Chris Brown, Aaliyah, Neo, Puff Daddy, and the whole Bad Boy family, Mario Winans, Teddy Riley and Guy, Teddy Riley and Blackstreet, Bobby Brown, Mary J. Blige, music director, 10 years, Faith Evans, Sierra, Lil Wayne, music director, Boyz II Men, musical director for New Kids on the Block, recording bassist for Aretha Franklin, the Winans, music director, Clark Sisters, Genuine, Avant, Darnell Jones, Carl Thomas, 112. Most recently, working with Motown, the Motown Museum, 60. I was the musical director for the Motown 60-year anniversary, his field honors. I'm also teach master classes at the Motown Museum Amplified and Ignite summer program. That's pretty much most of it. It's a lot of other little things. And L. Grover Washington Jr., because I love jazz. So I played with Grover for about 4 years. Also worked with Detroit's own Mr. Earl Klue, which was probably my first major gig, jazz gig, worked with Earl Klue here in Detroit.
That's awesome. I noticed you're on board with – I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm just saying
I know that you're on board.
I recorded it.
Go ahead.
Will Smith, LL Cool J, Aretha Franklin, Mary J. Blige, Jay-Z. And most recently, we're working on a new artist in Detroit called Deshondra, which is a gospel artist that's going to be coming out soon, and she's amazing.
That's great. Thank you. I know you're on board with the bringing of Motown back. However we wanted to find it, but at any rate, we're bringing it back. What do you feel... I'm going to ask you this, and I'm going to turn you over to Michael. What do you feel? What do you feel would have happened with Motown had Bear Gordy not sold?
I feel that it would have continued to strive because each prior artist influenced the next generation. So I think if we were able to still witness and celebrate the Motown artists here in Detroit, it would have encouraged even more and more upcoming artists and you know, the children and the descendants to follow the footsteps of the most successful company, one of the most successful companies in America, which was Motown, which was basically right here in our backyard. I was able to study with the Funk Brothers as a kid, so I just think it would have continued, because like Teddy Harris and Bings Bowl and Earl Van Dyke and James Jamerson and Jamerson Jr., they actually were a part of this program here in Detroit where they were teaching. That's when I got into the program with Kim Weston, put together this program for our kids. So a lot of kids, hundreds of kids, was coming through that program. So I think if it was still been here, these kids would have developed, and with some of them still had developed and went on to work with Stevie Wonder and people like that. So I just think it would have continued, and I think we still would have been just the next generation of Motown.
But it's not too late, right?
Oh, no, the talent is still here. It's just the opportunity left.
Okay.
Like the
so
people is
one.
Yeah, it's just a clog where they can't get the training, they can't get the information, and they can't get the outlet for all these enormous singers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Michael, gonna give you the floor.
Yeah, appreciate that. Once again, how you doing, Mr. Brantley? Good to have you here.
Hi, Michael. Thank you, sir.
I wanted to actually play off of a question Dr. Lee asked you about what you thought would happen to Motown, or what Motown would be like, the state it would be in today if Berry Gordy hadn't sold. I want to ask you, if, let's say that did happen, Berry Gordy didn't sell and Motown was still, you know, in that state where he hadn't sold it, do you think that Motown would have been receptive to, let's say, you know, obviously hip-hop is the biggest musical genre on the planet now. Do you think Motown would have been receptive to the rise of hip-hop? Do you think it could have facilitated it, or do you think maybe it wouldn't have mixed?
I think it would have facilitated because of that next generation of kids who were listening to studying, because Eminem is from Detroit. He used to come to Detroit every week to hang out with Proof and the guys. So those same kids that was running around that produced 8 Mile soundtrack and Big Sean, that lived on Otter Drive down the street from Marvin Gaye's house, they just would have been the next. I think it would have continued to strive that, you know, hip hop is a what's the evolution of music. That was like how bebop went, jazz went to bebop. So I think it just would have evolved from the Motown sound to a more sophisticated hip hop, because like Mr. Wilson said, we're used to hearing arrangements. Like, we study with Paul Reiser and Quincy Jones, and we're influenced by musical instruments and stuff. So it would have been probably more organic if Detroit was able to evolve in the hip-hop area. But, yes, we definitely would have spread into the hip-hop area, the gospel area, the jazz area, the rock and roll area, because we pretty much already have, you know, with the Winans and Clark Sisters and Commission, we already kind of cornered that church feeling, that good old Detroit soul, R&B, factory working feeling that we all just know naturally from just growing up here. So I just think it would have just evolved up to the next level with hip-hop. We definitely would have embraced it because Detroit is I don't want to say a ghetto city, but it's a rough city. So hip hop is just a reflection of what's happening in the streets.
Adversity.
So the whole new jack. Yeah. So that adversity would have came out in our music as artists.
Okay, I can definitely see that. Less corporate, less formulaic, more conscious, so to speak. More kind of like what you know, to an extent. I know a lot of people didn't like it because of how real it was. A vulgar it was, but kind of like what 90s rap and 80s rap was to an extent, even though it was, you know, about gang life, it was still realistically about what was actually going on. So kind of more realistic instead of, you know, I know what happens nowadays too, which is kind of interesting, where someone will be given a deal who isn't from a particular background or environment, but will be advised by, I guess, their kind of advisors or their handlers to pretend as if they have all this street experience, so to speak.
Yeah.
So probably less of that. Yeah.
Yeah. the street experience is real in Detroit. It's real. Like, you see things. Things do happen just because of the environment. And the whole, when Detroit went bankrupt and the crime was rampant and all that. So that whole Young Boys Incorporated and BMF, that whole movement that was sweeping through Detroit, it was real. And a lot, you know, but I think it would have reflected in the music as well. And it does in some of the music that's out now, some of the rappers that are coming out of Detroit now, like T-Grizzly and Sada Baby and then those guys. They're just talking about street life.
Absolutely.
You know,
now,
it's musical.
Considering your extensive experience in the music industry and all your, you know, accolades, I wanted to ask you, do you see a chance for more independent artists that aren't necessarily backed by a large label or aren't kind of concocted by whatever corporate formulas, music formulas, celebrity formulas they've got in the back room? Do you see a chance for those independent artists to break through and actually gain a similar level of prominence as some of the more mainstream, you know, industry plants or corporate artists?
Yeah, I think so, because of the internet, people can listen to what they want to listen to. Now, a lot of, even for artists, it's an advantage kind of not to be signed to a big label, because once you get in that label, then now you're fighting for your masters and you're fighting for the rights of your songs. But when you own your music and you're in this, your own independent source, you have more control over where that money goes and where that music goes once it's being sold and distributed around the world.
Given
so
those
more
benefits,
control, I think so, yeah.
Absolutely, go ahead.
Well, no, I'm just saying, I think it's just more control for the artist to be independent sometimes.
Absolutely, and given those benefits of, you know, controlling and owning your own, what do you think the allure is for new artists? What is that, what causes them to take that record deal? Is it a combination of, you know, ignorance of the importance of owning your own, as well as their desperate situation, being offered a lot of money, a big bag, so to speak? What do you think that allure is for them to take that industry deal over being independent?
Yeah, it was definitely the money, and I think it's the whole, like, the security blanket. Like, if you go to the store and you can buy a bag of chips by Lay's, you might say, well, those are Lay's, I'm going to buy those. But if you see some chips by JoJo Chips, you might not buy those chips, you know, because you don't have that comfort of who are these guys. But if you say MCA or Universal or the big label, I think the allure is the fact that I'm with a big company. I'm with Universal. I'm with Sony. And the machine that's behind and the corporate structure that's behind these bigger labels, it kind of give you a sense of security that you know that they're not going to run out of money. And you know that they'll fund the tour, and you know that you'll make it to certain radio stations and television stations that regular independents may not be able to break through, where if Universal sends the record in, it's going to be played. So I think that's the allure. They think they'll get more grounding, even though they'll lose more control, but then they'll pick up on the other end as far as having more power behind that record.
Right. So kind of based on, I guess, subconscious branding, would you say, of certain big, you know, corporations, mm-hmm. like a Universal, like a, you know, a Def Jam Records, if they know the name and they've been kind of conditioned to associate that name with success, with money, they're not going to be as willing to, you know, support a record label that's more independently owned or owned by someone who isn't, who's actually from their community.
Right. Yeah, I think so.
Gotcha.
I think so.
Okay, well, appreciate that. Thank you for that insight. Let me ask you, given your extensive experience in the music industry, what are some of the most memorable or impactful connections you've made?
Well, definitely meeting Mr. David Foster. That was it was incredible. I heard he was looking for a bass player, and a friend of mine called me, so I took a chance. I flew out to L.A. and you know, got a hotel and found out where the audition was and made it there on time, an hour early actually. And I had studied the music, you know, extensively before I left Detroit, so I felt pretty good about the music. So that was a great experience. Just playing for, you know, this guy has produced Celine Dion and Whitney Houston and Barbara Streisand. And here I am, a guy from Detroit. So he even asked me, like, well, what do you know about this type of music? And I had to explain to him that growing up in Detroit, I was around people like Thomas Whitfield and Marvin Wine. And so I was always exposed to arrangements and orchestration. So when it came time to play a Barbra Streisand song or a Whitney Houston song, it was really easy for me because of all my Detroit experience, you know, with some of the best musicians here. So, yeah.
And what is it about what you do specifically when it comes to being a musical director? What is it about being a musical director that makes you most passionate, that I guess lights that spark or that fire in you that keeps you coming back to doing that? What is it about directing, being a director of music? Because obviously you're a musician, you play an instrument as well, but what is it about directing that, you know, stimulates you?
Well, I think it's the sense of responsibility. Because when you're the music director, you're responsible for that show happening. If the artist says, I needed to start raining right here, and I need to hear thunder, that thunder got to happen. So it gives you that, like, it's like you're the one driving the ship. You're the captain, and you pick the crew, so you pick your men. You know, I select my guys, hand-pick them to know that I can trust them to do their part because it's a team effort. You know, the drummer has a duty. He's the quarterback. The guitar player, you're the icing on the cake. The keyboard players, you guys are the pads. The lead singer, he sits on top of that whole big cake. But as a music director, it's my responsibility to make sure that every section is doing what they're supposed to do. And so, yeah, so that's what kind of drives me, the sense of responsibility and knowing if it's a great concert, you know, I was responsible for putting that together, and it was my team and a lot of my ideas in collaboration with the artist and the creative director to make that vision. You know, Beyonce, she would already know what she wants. So she'll just explain to, this is my vision. This is what I want. And it's my job to make that come to life. Whether it's a choir or a marching band or you know, a horn section or whatever, string section, whatever it is that the artist requires, that's their responsibility as an MD.
Excellent. So would it be more appropriate, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, to call you a musical director or a performance director? Because it seems like you're directing a little bit more than music, actually.
Yeah, it's kind of a combination, music and performance, and even management a little bit, because I have to negotiate the musician's salary sometimes. Like, they'll come to me and say, well, what are we paying these people? They won't go to these people individually. And so I'm kind of like the middleman in between the artist and the manager and the band, where they may not want to speak to the band directly, but they'll come to me and say, okay, this person here is messing up, or I don't like this, I don't like that. And then I have to go back and communicate that to the band members, you know. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's kind of more of a musician, because you have to be creative, because they come to you for ideas constantly.
Right. Got you. Well, it definitely sounds like more than a musical director. It sounds like you're kind of the guy to go to when a musician wants to get something done. When they got a performance, you're kind of the guy they have to go to actually make it happen. So,
yeah,
definitely a big picture guy. It sounds like you have to be or girl to orchestrate something like this. Someone who's able to see the macro.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Pretty much. Yeah.
Was that Dr. Lee?
No, I was saying a business-minded type of person as well. It's you're utilizing business skills, negotiating and planning, directing, all of those are skills of a business person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mr. Brantley, what does it look like when – you know, because you said you have done work organizing tours for different artists. What is that experience like? What does it look like when you're organizing a tour and, you know, maybe someone who was supposed to perform something last minute doesn't perform it, someone, and you have to pick up the slack. What does it look like when you have to kind of be put under pressure to rearrange something last minute to make something still happen or to bring the show about even when there's some complications?
Well, you got a lot of thinking on your feet, you know, like say, for instance, the computer blows, the band. See, I always have my musicians prepare for anything. Say if the sound blows out or the speaker goes out, we got to keep going. So the drummer knows, don't stop. You just keep going. Even if they can't hear nothing else, they're going to still hear those drums. And you just keep going until we fix it. And whoever in charge of production, it needs to be fixed. It's kind of like I kind of prepare myself for worst case scenarios and just, you know, hope that everything goes smoothly as planned. And then we rehearse a lot. So anything that happens at rehearsal, you know, if it's not rehearsed, I don't like to take it on the stage because I don't like being spontaneous. I want to be comfortable and I want the artist to be comfortable. So we know right here, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do that. And if something just happens at the spur of the moment, that's out of our control, everybody knows to just kind of hold the ship until we can fix this. So, you know, it's a team effort that everybody knows to kind of go automatically into that that mode of repair mode or something. She might want to change the key at the last minute, so you have to be prepared to transpose. You know, I suggest all my musicians can read music, so that way if we have to take something out of the chart, we can just omit it from the chart. So it just depends on the people that you hire. You got to make sure you got comfortable people on your team who can, you know, and then it ain't no going to sleep. Like, you never go to sleep. If something's going wrong, there's no going to the hotel. You ain't going to sleep. You're going to be up all day and night until this is fixed. And that's what it is.
Absolutely. Now, a little different kind of question. There's rumors about, you know, this so-called flow state, when people who are professionals in their craft really get into the zone, they go into this state where there's kind of like running on autopilot. Does that happen where you're getting into kind of your zone when you're playing with other musicians and you're coordinating everything and you guys kind of go into one kind of hive mind? Have you ever experienced that kind of shared flow state?
Yes. On the big level, we don't do that. But like if I'm playing like more of an open kind of gig, a more free-flowing gig, then we kind of go with the flow. A lot of the big gigs, just because there's timing and there's a time limit and there's other factors like choreography and lighting that all have to coordinate, so you can't just go off the beaten path. But if it does happen to go that way, then, you know, we know how to follow the artist, you know. We know how to follow that artist and make sure that we you know, so it depends on the show, the type of show. If it's a program show that everything has to, you know, at 7 o'clock this happens, at 7:15 this happens, at 7:30 this happens, and we've got a set pattern, we try to stick to the pattern. You know, if the show's supposed to end at 10 o'clock, we're not going to keep grooving to 10:30 and then everybody get fined by the union. At 10 o'clock, we need to be hitting that last note. But, you know, it depends on the gig. It kind of depends on the gig.
Right. Would you say that improvisation is a skill, though, at least that the musicians you work with, you would expect them to have, just in case while you're doing a planned orchestrated event, you know, something like a computer blows out and you do have to think on your feet? Is improvisation a factor?
Yes, sir.
Absolutely.
Yes, sir,
great.
Most definitely. Yeah, you should be as versatile as possible. You should be as versatile as possible and try to prepare for everything so that when something happens, you're already kind of pre-prepared for that, you know. So, yeah, it's a lot of pre-production. It's a lot of pre-planning and pre-production on some of these, especially on a tour type situation.
Absolutely. Let me ask you one more question, then I'll open it up to the other co-hosts. I asked you a couple minutes ago about what it looked like when you kind of have to pick up the slack for something, when something goes wrong. What would you say? What was your best performance where everything went right, when you didn't have to, you know, really improvise that much, when everything kind of fell into order in a very copacetic way? What would you say was your best performance where everything's just great?
Wow. Well, actually, one of my performances in China, because, you know, the Chinese are so meticulous in the way that everything is prepared. And a few times we've had, like, amazing shows where every aspect from the lighting to the effects to the sound to the dancers, and it all just moved in sync through the whole. So that's like one of the recent shows we did in China, a New Year's Eve concert with Jay Lin. And then another one was Lady Gaga live at Madison Square Garden. That was a flawless show. It was amazing.
Excellent, excellent. Any of the other co-hosts, if there's a comment, a question that you want to add,
yeah,
that you want to throw out there?
Well, thank you. Great conversation, and I appreciate you. We have some audience. We want to go to turn to our audience and give our call-iners, take some, at least a couple questions from our callers before we go to Dr. Cannon or Dr. Tatum. Let's see, error code 301-0386. You have a question? Error code 301.
Thank you very much. Good evening. I did get my question answered. Thank you. I appreciate it. It's a fantastic show. This is Berenice. Greetings to everyone.
Okay.
Thank you.
I got my question answered
so
during the conversation.
During the conversation. Okay,
yes.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much. Peace and blessings.
You're welcome. Same to you. Okay, so then we'll go on to error code 248-2302. 248-23.
Julie, this is Paula.
Oh, hello. Hi, Paula.
And the panel, how are you guys? I just wanted to say it's good to hear everything that you're doing, and I appreciate you having my brother Kern on. And I wanted to just kind of, I didn't have a question, but I wanted to speak about some of the other things that were going on in the city that kind of prepared some of the young artists at the time when they were younger that went on in the city that doesn't happen in a lot of cities. And in fact, we have lost touch with, like Kern mentioned, one of the programs that was happening at the time. But there are some PAL leagues, and I remember being a debutante, and I danced with an Alvin Ailey team, and I had to go to charm school and living behind Barry Gordy's home. There was a lot of little things that came into play when I was 6-7 years old, that modern dance and ballet and piano lessons that a lot of the parents were doing in preparation for some of the Motown artists that we didn't even realize that what was going on because our parents mm-hmm. listened to that music. Mm-hmm. You know, I was given the opportunity by my mom and dad to play an instrument and to take ballet and ultimately, you know, be in a group that traveled, a black dance group that traveled across the country. So there were some other things that went on in preparation to getting the Motown performance in order because there were certain things that we were taught when it came to discipline and somebody messed up, you know, we had to do it over and over and over and over. There was relentless practicing. And the culture of how we were raised in the music business, I don't think it's talked about a lot, and Kern can attest to that, you know, working with some of the great directors and how, Kern, you remember being having to practice and practice and practice and practice, and there
yeah,
seemed like there
hours.
Was no end, but it was, yeah, but it was a labor of love. It wasn't like, you really didn't feel like you were practicing, but, I mean, it was perfection at 10, 12, 11, 13 years old that it's just not talked about enough, I think. And we can get back to that when we start to recreate or rebuild or regenerate the Motown. We got to instill into the youth the importance of the hours and the time that's needed, you know, to perfect your craft.
Right.
And,
a lot of these professional artists are workaholics. And a lot of them are workaholics. Like when I work with Beyonce, she works around the clock. And that's why she's so successful, I think. And that's why she's so perfect on stage because they spend hours in dance and hours in the band room and hours in the studio.
Yes.
But it pays off in the long run. Like all those hours that I used to rehearse, now it's easy for me just to pop up and do a 2-hour show because it's just something that I've been doing, so it's no big deal.
Right. We were raised like that.
Absolutely. Certainly we appreciate you very, very much. I have a question, but I wanted to we go back to Dr. Tatum and then to Dr. Cannon for your want to give you an opportunity to ask a question or comment, Dr. Tatum. Okay, while we're waiting for Dr. Tatum, we'll ask Dr. Cannon.
Absolutely, sir. You know, it's a beautiful thing. All the people you had a great opportunity to work with. You know,
thank you, sir.
This is James Cannon. Nick Cannon's my son. We've had the opportunity to work with the 400-year commission, which is for us as Afro-American people to be able to tell our story all over this nation. One of the things we wanted to do was do some music, I want to say contests like remixing the Negro National Anthem and getting new renditions of that made across the country with artists that could add their expertise and their style to songs that are that we don't never ever want to go away, like Lift Every Voice and Sing, like Sam Cooke, A Time, A Change Is Going to Come, where we can get our artists of today excited, our producers today excited in a contest over the internet with the 400-year commission to be able to do that. I wanted to put that on the table. But my question was in looking at how do we create the climate again, when understanding that we're in a world market and now it doesn't take as what it took, you know, 30 years ago to create music, and it doesn't take what it took 30 years ago to market music. And it would be equivalent, though, if we had talented young baseball players in our cities, but none of our kids want to go to practice. They don't want to learn the fundamentals. They could play the game, and if they play the game, they become superstars because it's inside of them. How do we take the talent that's in our cities across the country? Since you've had an opportunity to travel in other countries and see that there's money that we could be learning how to go after with our talent if we lift up and understand that we're in a world economy. We're in a world market now where it doesn't take as much to produce music. It doesn't take as much to market music. What are young people missing today when they're full of talent? But is it that we're smoking too much pot to where we're not as creative as they were 30 years ago? The opportunities look like they've gotten better. And many of our young people like Nick have come to the forefront, but there's so many others that is not taking advantage of the God-given talents that we have on the inside of us. In this world economy, my question is, how do we set a climate in our cities, our inner cities, where they look like they're dilapidated, but yet we still have talented, talented, talented people living in these cities? But is it that we don't have the motivation to unify? The Jewish people have showed us how to do it. How do we take that industry where they're making millions and billions off of us? How do we set the climate across the country in every city in 2021, so we take that industry back? If the whole world looks over to America, they don't look to the black people that's controlling our own music. How do we take that back in a climate where it appears to be easier to do, but yet it seems like we fall into apathy? a lack of motivation. Why can't we come to the front of the line in every city across the country and take what we know we do well, music, we know we do it, second to none. Why can't we take that right now, every city, and start controlling is my question.
Okay, it seems like it's a lack of education and understanding with the young people. Like a couple of the older people kind of get it, but I think the young people, they don't get it because they got to see it. They're in this generation that you got to show me. You can tell them about stuff, but until they see it visually or see the success or see the bling bling or the hype or whatever it is that catches their attention, you got to kind of educate. Because, see, a lot of these kids are growing up listening to garbage music. See, I grew up listening to real music. But a lot of these kids, like my granddaughter, she would sing a song to be out of key, and I'd be like, you don't hear that? And she's like, well, no. And then I listen to the music. I say, oh, you're listening to garbage. It's like you're eating Burger King all day and McDonald's, and now you're trying to figure out why you're sick. It's like, so they're being fed. They're not being fed good music. Back in the day, we were with Earth, Wind, and Fire and all these groups. We were being fed real musicianship. But now they don't see the bass player. They don't see the guitar player. The musicians aren't important. They kind of took the musicians out of it. And what thing that Motown did, Barry let the musicians make the decisions. The musicians made the arrangements, the songwriters, the producers, who are also musicians. But nowadays, with these computers and these internets and loops and video games and samples, they've actually kind of took the musicians out of the music. And that's one of the big problems, because they can't feel it. They hear it, but they don't feel it.
So from a money-making standpoint, then, do we try to bring the music back in, the musicians back in, or do we roll with the new system and we master that new system better than anybody else? I guess what I'm saying is the talent is in every city across the country. I went to American Idol, where they had thousands of beautiful singers. Every aisle you walk down, this was a competition where you come to get judged. And everywhere you turn, beautiful voices. But American Idol did not have a plan for all those beautiful voices. The only thing they wanted is what they came to get, the two or three voices they came to get out the city. But they had people staying up all night, 5 in the morning, waiting to get in, get an audition. But what I noticed was that production, even though they had talented people all around that could sing up a yin-yang, they didn't have a plan or a vision to capture that. How do we go back into our city and educate our kids and stimulate our kids, not just in music but in producing and in every area, in every area where our ancestors have already proven that you can make money with this, proven that we do this better than everybody else. And it looks like if we lay down in Chicago and the gangbangers shooting and killing each other, when you got talented in Detroit, they were singing on the street. What do we have to do to create the climate? Well, we can take the world, take our music and our talents to the world, not just to the United States. You travel the world. Is the world waiting for us, waiting for our music? Is the world waiting for our talent? And if so, how do we get it together to give it to them?
Right. Well, it's like the world is, it seems like to me the world is taking what we create and then they improve on it and run with it. So we have to figure out a way to educate the kids so they can get it from an early age, so they can know, instead of growing up to get 16 and 17 and thinking drugs and guns is the way to go, and keeping the instruments in their face and keeping the creativity. But we have to incorporate the old with the new. We can't take the musicians out. The musicians have to just come up to a next level of understanding technology and the way things are doing now. Because, like, one thing I noticed in China, Chinese people are still listening to real chord changes. Like, you can't give them a little drum beat and tell them it's a hit. They're not taking that. They want to hear violins. They want to hear the melody. Mm-hmm. They want to hear the bass. They want to hear the drum beat. They don't move to just a beat, where here you can just throw in a beat and just go wah, 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 and that's a hit. And,
right.
But we have to somehow educate these kids and bring real music somehow mm-hmm. back into it by mentoring, right. by showing, by example, so they need to see something, whether it's a video or a cartoon mm-hmm. or something. And then these artists that are out, they need to change the atmosphere with their lyrics. Like, they need to start singing slowly or incorporating more educational and more positive messages instead of mm-hmm. this negative stuff that you hear on the radio, but still keep it, because it grabs their attention. They want to hear those dark beats and those dark lyrics, but we got to somehow figure out how we flip that to be a company that produces music that's not dark.
I'm curious.
And so that's all genres of music, then, sounds like. This is what they do in exactly what you say they do in China. They're taught all types of music, and they know the scales. They know the sounds, and they start very early. Yes, and very early in life from listening. So someone interested. So this is helping us a lot, because there is an area of education that we can focus in on at a very young age, and mm-hmm. you can make it available in these communities. And so this is really, really, really good. We're
music appreciation.
Go ahead.
I'm curious. Yeah, I'm curious too. Then with as many historical black colleges that we have, with as many black churches that we have, even if they take the music programs out of the public school systems, how excited or how impressed or where do you think the black churches and the black colleges need to step in to fill the gap as far as musicianship? A lot of young men can get in the band once they get to college in a lot of our historical black colleges, but I think we can do more there to keep our music alive. But how about with the black churches? Are you impressed? Because if they take the study of music out of the schools, but yet we have churches, have you seen churches step up where they've got music departments, or they've got music instruments and equipment for the young people, where they turn some of their rooms into studios for the community can come in, and so the young people can do their thing and put their music together? With all the churches that we have across the country, how impressed are you with the churches that you've seen in the black community, particularly because we got so many black churches? Or have the black churches failed us in picking up where the school system has? It may not was the school's job to teach music, but what about the churches and the black colleges is my question.
Well, the black churches definitely is very important, because most of the best musicians all start in church. Like, I'm a church musician. Most of the most successful musicians, even Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg, these guys are church musicians at heart. Teddy Riley's church musician. A lot of these producers that's writing these songs, we all come from that church feeling, because if you can play jazz and gospel, you can put hip-hop and pop and R&B. That's enough. That's easy. So the church is very important, but the thing about the church, they limit you when you get to that point that they say what you're doing is bad. Like, I went through a situation when I was a gospel musician, and then I got a call to go on the road with a popular R&B band. And then all of a sudden, everybody's looking at me like, you can't do that. And I'm like, wait a minute. They're paying a whole lot of money, number one. Number two, I'm proud to go around the world with these guys. And they're working with everybody, from Michael Jackson to everybody. So why do I have to feel bad or like I'm doing something wrong because I'm expanding my musical? So I think sometimes in the church, they'll let you get so far, and then they'll say, okay, you're a great musician, but you can't play for Whitney Houston, or you can't play for Michael Jackson, or you can't play for Prince. And then that's when, okay, wait, I'm grown, I got kids, and I need to make some money. And playing at Sunday and Saturday at the church ain't gonna get me that $10,000-$20,000 a week check that I can get on the road with one of these big pop bands. So that's them, that little gray area where you make that transition from gospel which it is secular, what they call secular music. So that's, I mean, that's, I think that's the thing. The church got great musicians, but I know a lot of musicians that probably would have been a lot further if they didn't just stay with gospel. And nothing wrong with that. I mean, I love it. I'm doing gospel music right now, and I've always will continue to do gospel music. But we have, they have to allow us to be versatile as musicians and not put our job as a prerequisite to something that we shouldn't be doing. Because
so then,
just singing
so then
about
I would gather then you have a slight disappointment with the musicianship and ability that's coming out of the church, because they could do so much more in preparing young people. How do they prepare young people? And based on what you've seen, working with so many different artists, how could the church better prepare the young people, not just to sing gospel, but not sing garbage music, but being able to take a talent that could become marketable? That, you know, it's kind of like the church then, the musicians sneak away from the church, quietly sneak away from the church to go do their thing and make their money. Well, how can you utilize all that beautiful strength inside the church, inside the black church, to prepare these young people to say, come to the church, we can prepare you in these areas of music? It ain't gospel, you ain't singing about Jesus, because you're not called to the ministry, the ministry of the psalmist, but you have a gift. And how can we cultivate that gift in our churches? What can we create so that the kids will feel comfortable, the parents will feel comfortable coming to the church to learn musicianship, to be able to go out into the world, not to sing garbage. I'm not talking about garbage. We don't need no more garbage. But I'm talking about good skills, beautiful music. How can we, again, if we've got hundreds of churches across the country, and a lot of them are paid for, how can we compel them brothers to open up the door, to synergize, to set new structure so we can say to our kids and our parents, send your kids over here. We're going to tell them to put their guns down and pick up these trumpets,
pick up these keyboards,
pick up these cameras.
Yeah, pick up a bass, a guitar. Yeah, well, that's how we can do exactly
like
you
said. Do it from the church.
A positive, but it has to be something positive. Like, you know, showing them that, number one, you can make a lot of money, even though money shouldn't be your only motivation. But if you do it right, you can make a living off of being a writer, a producer, a musician, artist as well. So I think the church, with the facility and the talent pool, because the talent is in the churches, it's just that transition period of crossing over from straight gospel music to secular, worldly, more worldly music, and you're going to get, you know, you're going to get some racy lyrics in there, but
there's
things
gonna
probably be limited.
Resistance.
It's going to be resistant.
There's
going to
always be, because of the type of music, and there's going to always be some resistance with the church, especially when you have people going, leaving your congregation. I mean, I can talk about the black church all day and all night. That's where I, you know, grew up and been for so many years. And so there's a level of pastoral control in the black church.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then we're talking about tithing and offering. You know, we all know that, you know, these leaders, these pastors don't want you to get too far away with your money.
Exactly. Okay? Exactly.
And so you're out there, that's something that they cannot control on the outside once you go on the outside of the door. But there was a statement that Mr. Wilson made earlier regarding the regarding an awakening, the awakening of creators, of who we are, that this, you know, he stated in so many words that it is our time now. Things are changing. We're waking up. We know who we are now, you know. And so what is your take on that? You recall that conversation, Kern? And I like what your feelings is on it. Okay.
Yeah, so what it creates, I think I agree with Mr. Wilson as well. If we put it under the term of a creator or creative people and not a religious thing, and it's more about being creative, then we would be able to attract more young people and more people to doing that, because they're not, they don't feel like they're limited. And but I think it definitely should be an awakening of sonically awakening of sounds and music, because sounds and tones have a lot of influence on people the way they feel. Because I've been studying music therapy a little bit for like work with patients and stuff like that. That's something I'm trying to get into, where music heals people and people in the hospital and stuff like that. So it's certain tones out here that make you react a certain way. It can make you sad. It can make you happy. It can make you sleepy, you know. So we need to study that and then learn the business side. Because I think if people know that they're getting paid and they know the worth of their intellectual property, that would inspire them more to, you know, to like really harness, so we're not just writing music and not owning it, or creating scenarios, or creating TV shows and stuff like that, or creating films and not owning that content. So that they need to be educated in ownership as well as the creative side of it, and then being in a comfortable environment where you can be creative without feeling like, oh, I can't say this word because it's a bad word, or this you know, it has to be open. It has to be open up for them to be creative.
Thank you. Dr. Tatum, are you here? Dr. Tatum, we're going to go back to Michael for some final questions, and then we'll each one of us will have our final comments.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Michael.
Did you have something to say, Dr. Annie? You can go ahead.
No, I was just going to wait for the closing. But, you know, in looking at the fact, you know, where we have so much talent, somebody has to go into these cities and sift the talent, and there we'll find the winners. You know, even in television production, you know, when Mel Gibson made the movie The Passion of Christ, you know, I think the church should have stepped up right then and started getting into productions. If more churches, you know, turned some of their buildings into production rooms. And I think they have to learn to do that now. They can call the kids, teach them how to run cameras, teach them how to produce, direct, get into film festivals. You know, we have the talent, you know, and to create the Motown style, somebody has to be there to recognize it and help polish it. Jesse Jackson said, you know, can't nobody help us but us. You know, so we have to be the ones to recognize, you know, the talents of these kids and set the programs. I look at the baseball industry that has turned almost totally Hispanic. And very few of our children are playing baseball. But they signed $50 million contracts coming out of high school. You know, other ethnic groups that can't even speak English, but they know they can hit that ball. They know they can catch that ball. They can master that. And if they master that, their life changes. I think we have tools, natural gifts that God has given to us. And I think all of us as a people have to go down deep and look what's on the inside of us, and then count up the cost. And what is it going to take for me to go to the next level? What is it going to take for me to get the pastor of the church to open up this church on Friday and Sunday, Saturday night for the young people to come in and do their thing, to put their music together? And the pastor can critique it and tell them, nah, that's garbage. But at least the pastors are opening up the doors and telling them that the gangbangers, y'all, or the musicians, or the brothers that's out there hanging out and ain't got no place to go. They don't have a studio. But I wonder if my son and I put a studio in five churches in every city, churches, we're going to pimp your church with a new studio where young people can come in here and do their thing, but you got to put the call out there. You got to manage it and control it. Because what I found is if we teach our young kids the fundamentals, then they'll go out there and they'll go to the front of the line with that. But if they sit home and they have gifts and talents and nobody polishing and helping them polish them gifts and talents,
and they'll sit down on themselves. They'll fail by forfeit, not even showing up. So I think, you know, my brother, I love what you're doing. I want to synergize with you some more. I want to work along with our foundation, the Cannon Foundation, getting these young people excited about the talents that they have on the inside. We motivate you through the media. So we want to work along with you in doing that. Dr. Lee, I think this has been an outstanding conversation. I think we need to have more like this, get some more of these mothers that have sons to get on the show like this so that they can hear from powerful young men like this that's done it, that's traveled the world, that's worked with everybody. And if you don't have a foundation up, young man, you need to get your foundation up so that you can pour into these young men across this nation through your foundation.
Yes, sir.
And so it's
yes,
been
sir.
Outstanding, so I appreciate
it. Yeah, one thing that Kim Weston did from Motown, I know you all know who Kim Weston is, she put together a summer youth program, and she went to Mayor Coleman Young, and she said, give me 300 kids from the city. They could come and audition to get in the program, but she was letting pretty much anybody in that kind of had talent. Because the kid with talent, their parents, they'll identify those kids. And what she did, she put them on a minimum wage salary just for the summer, for the 3 months of summer. I think it was like $7 an hour or something. But for a kid in, you know, junior high school, that's a lot of money. And so she put all these kids on they got a weekly paycheck from the city of Detroit to study music, dance, theater, technology, culinary arts, wardrobe, makeup, hair. And she had the top musicians from the Funk Brothers, who was the house band at Motown, and they were the instructors. And they were on salary. So they took a little minimum wage budget check and gave these kids a salary. And that's what kept me and people like Keith John and these guys that went on to work with Stevie Wonder and Kid Rock, because we were all kids in that program. And that's what made me want to. And that program, I was in the house band. So now when I'm doing bands now, I always go back to that summer youth program that I had to back up all these artists. So now I'm backing a professional artist. But it was a great program because it opened up, and we would do shows. Every week we would do a different show for the youth centers, for the prisoners, for the people in the old folks' home. We would go to the community centers and just perform for kids. But Kim Weston kind of organized this program. And everybody got paid $7 an hour. It worked for 4 or 5 hours a day. And then that just made us all continue to go. And everybody from that program continued to go have a career after that. But we learned from the older people. Everybody in there was the Funk Brothers. Earl Van Dyke was one of the instructors. Clifford Fears, who worked with Alvin Ailey, he was the dance instructor. Then you know, we taught kids how to be bodyguards. Like, you might not be a singer or a rapper, but you might be a good security guard or a road manager or a stage manager or a carpenter. So we incorporated everything that it takes to make a show happen with these kids.
I'm
it was
curious.
Great,
That's phenomenal.
I'm curious, what do you see now young musicians are doing to get their music out that's working? What do you see people that's been trying really hard, what can they do now with the new tools to take their music or their talent to another level?
The social media platforms, the Spotify, and like everybody can put out their own tune on Reverb Nation or Spotify or Apple Music. So I'm seeing a lot of people, especially rappers, who are just blowing up and just putting out songs, and they're putting out and they're making videos, because everything is viral now. So it has to be a visual. It can't just be a record. It has to have some type of, even if it's a hood video, they have to have some kind of point of reference of this artist and the story and the message. And we need to make it a positive. We need to clean the message up. It's too much negativity, I think, floating around for these kids to just gravitate to. And they need more positive role models and images to look at and look up to.
Absolutely.
Like a Nick Cannon. Nick Cannon is a very positive role model for kids, you know, because he's clean and he's educational and he's funny. And he shows black success. So a kid can look at him and say, I want to be like Nick Cannon. So we need more of those kind of role models. Like, we got Big Sean. He does a thing here in Detroit for the youth every year. And they look up to him as a role model So these kids need role models, just need to see something. You know, if they don't see nothing good, then they ain't going to really know nothing but what they see.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, what we were doing with Nick's Foundation is motivating young people through the media. You know, get your internet show on the air. Go down to your public access television station. Use their camera equipment. Use their studio. Use within your city. Start producing. If you want to host, and start hosting. You know, we had Nick at 12 interviewing the 100 most important people in the city. Get your interviewing skills up. Learn how to communicate. You know, take a group of people with you and go interview the mayor. You know, so getting our young people where they polish, you know, that's what we do through the foundation. Now we're in a world economy, so I just want to encourage every young person that if you got a dream on the inside, dream that dream, but then wake up and go live it out. You know, because your grandparents and our ancestors put a lot of blood and sweat in the ground of America. And I don't believe we're at the end of the world. I believe we're just getting started with this thing. I believe that, you know, if you have a dream, God's going to show you how to supernaturally bring that thing to pass. So dream a big dream. And you're going to have people around you to help you. And so if people want to come help you fulfill whatever your dream is, then you might as well have a big dream, because they're going to help you fulfill a small dream or a big dream. It's your dream. And if you're on fire with it, then people will come help you. They'll come throw the gasoline to keep you to burn. But you got to have it on the inside of you. So that's what we do through Nick's Foundation. Start with an internet radio show. Start with a Zoom show. But get out there and start doing it. Set you up a platform and make people know you. You got to have in your, I'm going to make people know me. And go on out there and do good work and don't be afraid. Get in the traffic, but be determined to get where you're going. If your budget is to have $2 million in the bank within a year, then work towards that goal. God's going to bless you and show you how to supernaturally get it done. Dr. Lee Michael.
Absolutely.
It's an outstanding show.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you very much. You know it. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Cannon. And Dr. Tatum, are you back? Are you
I'm back. I'm sorry. I had to talk with somebody about some important business in the film industry.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed this opportunity, Dr. Lee. I thank God for you allowing our good friend Bobby Wilson to come through. He supposedly might be coming through Dr. Cannon's ordination on August 1st. So those that are in California, August 1st, 6 o'clock at Loveland Church will be ordaining Dr. Cannon.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Well, we appreciate you, Dr. Tatum. And just always, you know, faithful, and I appreciate you all, and Michael. So we're going to get back to Michael now for you to wrap us up for tonight. I appreciate you very, very much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Lee. Before I give, you know, my final thoughts and wrap up the show, I just want to say, at least in my opinion, I think ownership is probably the most important element of this whole conversation as it pertains to cleaning up the music, so to speak, because I understand that, you know, Mr. Brantley, such as, you know, as well as myself, we don't, when people talk about cleaning up the music, sometimes people assume that it's coming from like a church perspective, but cleaning up the music doesn't have to mean ridding it of real street experience. If someone who's in the music industry is really from the streets, so to speak, that's, you know, completely fair game. We're just talking about ridding it of the formulaic corporate formula where you behave a certain way, you look a certain way, you dress a certain way and talk a certain way because you're appealing to stereotypes that people in, you know, the corporate side of the music industry have determined are more profitable to sell. And I think if we want to stop that, in my opinion, we do have to gain more ownership. Something that I do like in the community is what, you know, P. Diddy has done with his Revolt TV YouTube channel, and I think, I don't know if it's an actual TV channel, but I know he owns Revolt and he'll promote artists and even artists from outside the community you know, that aren't just black artists, but are involved in hip hop that, you know, emulate certain things they see in the culture. He'll actually kind of suck them up before other communities can, and he'll sign them so that he can control even even how people who aren't black are representing black culture. So I think that ownership is the most important thing, because that'll allow the community to have more of a say over what act gets promoted and how much. So I think that's the most critical element of, you know, successful business is control over the business that you're actually engaging in. And I just want to say that once again, you know, it's been another educational show. I want to thank our guests for joining us tonight and being willing to come on and share your experience with us, both Mr. Brantley and Mr. Wilson, and also for making yourselves accessible to our listening audience so they could partake in the conversation as well. And you shoot some questions at you and have you, you respond back to those. I also want to thank the other co-host and Dr. Lee for putting this whole thing together and enabling us to have conversations like this. And I hope that we can have more conversations like this in the future. So for tonight, thank you for everyone who tuned in, who listened. This has been the show, Dr. Mary Lee Live. Good night.
Thank you so very, very much.
All right. Mr. Kern, you can say your final thoughts. That's fine.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Well, I was just
also, Valdez, also you want to, your brother who's your partner.
Yeah, Valdez, my brother. He's a music director for Usher as well for 15 years. But I would like to thank you sincerely, Dr. Lee, Dr. Cannon, Dr. Tatum and Michael, and Mr. Wilson for having me be a part of this this forum. And I really appreciate what you're doing for the community, and I'm looking forward to working with you in the future on some things that would be awesome.
Absolutely, and thank you. God bless you all. Until next week, this is Dr. Mary Lee. God bless you.
Peace to the ancestors. Yes. Peace to Dr. Cornel West. Yes.